Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Stephanie von Friedeberg to the broadcast. Stephanie is the Chief Information Officer and Vice President for Information Technology Solutions at the World Bank Group, a role she's held since 2012. Among other responsibilities, Stephanie is in charge of driving IT strategy at the World Bank Group. She'll speak about the transformations she's led in our interview. Stephanie began her career at the World Bank in 1992, serving in a variety of roles, including Chief Information Officer for the International Finance Corporation, Manager for IFC General Manufacturing Investments in Russia and the former Soviet Republics, and Manager for IFC's Global Telecommunications Portfolio, among other roles. Stephanie is also on the advisory board of Box.org, the nonprofit-directed arm of Box.com, an online service that provides file sharing, collaborating, and other tools for files uploaded to its servers. She also serves as a leader of the International Finance Institution's Women in IT organization, which advocates for the advancement of women in IT, as well as sitting on the board of the Bank Fund Staff Federal Credit Union. Stephanie holds a bachelor's degree from the Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. She received her Master of Arts degree from the Lauder Institute at the University of Pennsylvania and an MBA from the Wharton School of Business, also at the University of Pennsylvania. I recently caught up with Stephanie in her office in Washington, D.C., and our conversation covered World-Class IT Principle 1, people, as we discussed the challenges of collaborating among the World Bank's diverse and widely dispersed employee set, Principle 2, infrastructure, as we discussed cloud, mobility, and the ways the World Bank has addressed recent technology trends, Principle 5, external partnerships, as we discussed Stephanie's experience at the board level of multiple organizations within the World Bank and among external organizations, as well as a variety of other topics. This is Peter High. Please consider reading my new book, Implementing World-Class IT Strategy, How IT Can Drive Organizational Innovation. The book covers topics such as the CIO as strategic facilitator, the development of IT missions, facilitating corporate and divisional strategy, the development of IT's own strategic plans, the development of enterprise architecture, reviewing, refreshing, and communicating strategy, and a variety of other topics. You can find it at Amazon.com, my publisher's website, Wiley.com, and at your better bookstores. Thank you very much. Well, Stephanie von Friedeberg, welcome to the Forum on World-Class IT.
Thank you very much, Peter. It's very good to be here.
Excellent. Well, I thought we'd begin with your roles as CIO and Vice President of Information Technology Solutions at the World Bank. Can you just describe your responsibilities within the bank?
Yeah, so my job is a relatively new one, and I am actually the CIO of the World Bank Group. So for the very first time, we've actually, over the course of the last several years, pulled all of the IT and technology together into one group to better leverage for all of the subsidiaries of the World Bank Group. So anything that has to do with internal communications, that has to do with any kind of application or platform, from the infrastructure all the way to, you know, a tiny rapid application app that we might build for somebody, you know, sitting in a country office, is all in the purview of the stack.
And as you mentioned, you have quite a diverse set of constituents. Employees of the World Bank Group are all over the world. They're in places with very differing quality of Wi-Fi access, for instance, and technology, perhaps. Obviously, a lot of people, even who are based here in Washington, travel to all sorts of different places. Can you talk a bit about the challenges and the ways in which you facilitate collaboration and communications in such a diverse employee set?
That's a great question. And when I came to this job almost 4 years ago, we were a Lotus Notes shop. We had mobile devices that were actually not owned by the corporation, but were owned by individuals. They were all sorts of different kinds of smartphones where people could use email and use telephone communications, and we paid really substantial roaming costs. We have 186 country offices. We had servers in 186 country offices. So to kind of put it in perspective for you, we have a very big wide area network. We have a big VPN. So I might be an investment officer based in Johannesburg, and I'm going to travel to, you know, DRC, right? And I'm going to try to access my email from that Lotus Notes server that sits in Johannesburg. My communication goes either through Paris, through Washington, or through Chennai, and then all the way back to South Africa, and then back to me. We were really very antiquated and looking backward. So our intention as the team was to say, okay, how do we get to a point where we can give access to anyone, anywhere, from any device, all of the information that we have at our fingertips in the World Bank Group? And we've really set about trying to do that differently, and thinking about all of our 186 country offices and how are they connected was one of the very first places we started. So we used to spend about $12 million a year on connectivity, and we have since upped that very substantially. We've expanded our MPLS, but in addition to that, we've used a lot of local internet providers, and we've divided our traffic and split it out in ways that make better use of the infrastructure that we can afford. And we've actually found, interestingly, in some of the most difficult places that we can get off of VSAT. And if we use VSAT, it's backup now. So we only have 15 offices that use VSAT as primary communication.
That's great.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that you're in the throes of quite a transformation, consolidation, centralization of IT, whereas IT had been very distributed historically. Now there has been much more consolidation and centralization, as I say. Can you talk a bit about the rationale for the change? Why now, and what were the purposes or the perceived benefits of doing so?
We call it actually one version 1.0 and version 2.0. So the first one was really consolidation. There are five organizations that make up the World Bank Group. Each one of those five organizations had their own IT organization. So they built their own MPLSs. They built all of their own applications. They managed all of their own servers. And four times, you know, World Bank Group presidents would come in and say, this doesn't make any sense. We're duplicating effort and we're spending too much money, and we could actually redirect that money. When President Kim came in, he looked and said exactly the same thing, but he's a really big believer in IT. And so he said, Stephanie, figure out how to pull all of these together. And really so that we can get the best value for the spend that we have and redirect that money to his twin goals, which is really about alleviating poverty and creating shared prosperity in the world. So the two biggest organizations are the IBRD, which is what people think of when they think about the World Bank, and the IFC, which is the private sector arm of the World Bank. So we took all of those two groups and put them together. And we have a very extended plan for how we will merge platforms, merge infrastructure, merge applications as they come due. So instead of saying, listen, we need $500 million to redo everything, we really looked at a horizon and said, let's do this logically as applications, as servers come due. And we've been, you know, kind of pulling the two organizations together over time. And it's already proved extremely valuable. So when you look at our strategy going forward, it's really about uniform platforms. It's about buying before we build, and making everything consistent across so that we can share. And yeah, that's been terrific. So as we moved into that, then the organization said, well, why are there 450 IT people who aren't in IT? And the answer was, well, you know, we have these little groups that have kind of sprung up in different places that do anything from IT support to building little applications. And what was happening is people were building little applications that weren't properly secure. They actually weren't built to production standard. And then they were becoming, you know, enterprise usable, and people were actually expanding on them. So again, President Kim, who's very IT savvy, said, let's centralize. So in our version 2.0, we pulled all those 450 people into our organization. And so that includes about 250 or so people who sit here in HQ, and then the rest in the country offices. And it's been a great experience, Peter. When I took over, this is a great example. In our Moscow office, IFC has two floors, and the bank has two floors. And we had IT people that worked for IFC and IT people that worked for the bank. And we had two separate MPLS links. When we took that over, we were actually able to consolidate the MPLS link, double its size for half the amount of money. So you begin to see where you can actually generate value by pulling, you know, the organizations together.
And I'm curious also, as somebody who led IT for the IFC, for instance, before taking on your current role, in consolidating in this way, have there been other ways that the different parts of the World Bank have been able to collaborate? Have there been insights that you've drawn by virtue of understanding the commonalities, perhaps in new ways, that have led to, you know, new insights as to where there are opportunities for the functions of the different parts of the World Bank to operate in concert?
Yes, and I think it's taking us time to get there. But one of the things that we really wanted to get accomplished was how do we actually get better collaboration platforms, knowledge sharing platforms, and to be able to do that across the World Bank and the World Bank Group, so that, you know, it wasn't just a particular silo inside the bank that was looking at agribusiness, right? But it may actually be anybody who's touching water in the World Bank Group. What are they doing, and how does that correlate to agribusiness? So we have been building uniform platforms that actually begin to make that happen. So how does knowledge flow better in the organization and across the organizations? And by creating uniform platforms, we're able to segregate what data needs to be segregated. So, you know, what's confidential and between the organizations, but what can be mutually shared. And I think as we push the envelope, we've been able to encourage the business to work more closely together as well. And tied together with that, the bank group itself and the bank has gone through a pretty large reorganization, which was very beneficial to technology because we were able to step back and say, gosh, in the past, there were all these different knowledge sites that were not linked together. They weren't talking to one another. And we were able to pull them together, create unified taxonomies, and have one knowledge platform that every one of the global practices inside IFC and inside the bank can use. So you can actually find things that, you know, you couldn't have found before. So it was improving search and all that kind of stuff.
That's interesting. I mentioned a moment ago that, of course, you had the leadership role in the IFC. You've been with the World Bank for 23 years this year, and you didn't join in IT. In fact, you do not have an IT background in terms of your education at all. You have an MBA, you have a foreign policy degree. So I'm curious, what has been your own personal path to IT, and what have been the advantages of having seen sort of the other side, if you will, and having been a consumer of IT at one point before becoming a leader within the function?
So there was an intermediate step in that process. So when I came to the bank group, I went to IFC, and I actually have a couple degrees in Russian area studies. So I spent most of the time working in the former Soviet Union. And at some point in IFC, they decided it would be really beneficial to just rotate their managers around because it would be good for us. So the CEO called me in and said, well, you're going to run the telecom team. And I sort of laughed out loud. And he said, no, I'm serious. You know, we want a strong woman to lead the group. There's a lot of men. And so I took over a group of about 25 or 30 people. They were all men. They were all engineers. And I, you know, the first couple of weeks I sat on the edge of my chair and thought, how did I get here? You know, I don't own a cell phone. I, you know, have no idea what we're doing. But over the course of 11 years, we went from an environment where there were 400 million cell phones in the world to, you know, 3.5 billion cell phones in the world. And we helped build a lot of those networks. And then we sort of branched off from that and said, okay, let's start looking at IT investments in emerging markets. What do those look like? What should they look like? What should we be investing in? So my knowledge of technology sort of grew from, okay, how do you just do investments overall in emerging markets, to how do you look at investing in technology in emerging markets, to Lars Tunnell, who was the CEO of IFC at the time, said, Stephanie, would you mind doing me a favor? And I said, what would you like me to do? And he said, just 2 years. Just go run the IT shop and you know, clean it up, align it to the business, because they're kind of building this way and we need things that are over here. And you can at least talk their language and you can help pull it back together. So I started that whole renewal process in IFC and trying to figure out how to better align the business. We introduced business process mapping. We introduced people who understood business process. We started talking about, you know, data science and data analytics and how do we pull all those kinds of things together. And I did that for 2 years. And then Bob Zolik, who was the president of the bank at the time, he said, you know, would you mind doing this job for me? It's been fantastic, Peter. And the reason why I think it's fantastic is that, unlike most of my colleagues who are technology people, I actually can bridge the gap between what the business needs, how we present what we do, and how we bring the right technology. So my teams are great on technology, and if I don't understand something, they can clearly explain it to me. I think where we had failed in the past was World Bank in particular was very strong technology-wise from kind of the late 1990s to the mid-2000s. We had actually introduced our MPLS. We had all of our offices connected. We were beginning to talk about how do we become a knowledge bank. We had created an official repository where people could find things. And then we sort of, we tailored off and we became a cost to be curtailed from an IT perspective as opposed to a really strategic partner to the business. So when I came in and I was able to take all of the IT people from across the bank and create a team, we've been able to say to the business, we don't want to be a cost to be contained, but we actually want to be a strategic driver that's going to make this whole idea of the twin goals and becoming a solutions bank possible. And we've been working at it incrementally and gaining, I think, really the trust of the business and you know, pulling those two things back together and aligning them. So we have a lot of business process mapping. We've done a lot of work in the back office and the middle office to say, you know, from a treasury perspective, from a controller's perspective, how do you take all those platforms? You know, do your processes make sense? Can we buy something off the shelf? Can we eliminate customization? Because we have a lot of customization in our environment. And slowly, you know, beginning to add value. And I think one of the other things that we've done is try to touch the end user and the consumer. So what is it that a task team leader or an investment officer needs to be really successful? So we used to give them really clunky computers. They used to have whatever phone they happened to buy. They used to bring their monthly bill in and hand it off to administrator. And there was the cottage industry in the back that said, okay, well, this person traveled here, so all these phone calls, right, we're going to reimburse them for. And we'll give them a stipend to pay some piece of... We couldn't build mobile applications for these people. There was nothing we could do. So we actually started with the PCs, and we did something that, I mean, the bank has never done before. And we rebid our PC contract. And instead of saying, this is completely driven by cost, here are all the technical specifications, I made a very large chunk of the percentage. What do people want to carry? So we had a bit of a bake-off between the different vendors. Okay, what PCs can you make available? What do they look like? How do they feel? And we got staff, and we took the main complex. We literally took it over, and we had people come in, and you could just drop in and say, I like this Lenovo. This Lenovo is actually a really nice machine. And we ended up getting machines that people wanted. We ended up getting them for substantially less than what we had them before. So that was sort of the start. And then the next was, okay, how do we get rid of Lotus Notes? Because we've been a Lotus Note shop forever, and we needed to figure out how to pull all those servers out of the country offices. So we started down the path to say it makes no sense for this organization not to be in the cloud. You know, imagine if, right, you're a task team leader and you're sitting in Myanmar, and the data center you're pulling data from is, you know, in Singapore, and it's giving you everything that you need on a tablet or a lightweight laptop. Your life is going to be really different. So how do we transition from 5 data centers, which are all within a 80-mile radius of Washington, D.C., to a distributed cloud-based infrastructure? And we kind of tied that together with email to say, okay, well, let's start there. What's out there? And we took a very bold step and moved the entire organization to O365 in about a 6-month period. That, again, made a huge difference to people, and it was a substantial cost saving. We saved somewhere in the range of somewhere between 40 and 50% of our running cost by moving to O365. And again, people said, gosh, we actually have a modern email system, and we have a calendar that works. And then we're now introducing CRM. You know, one of the questions that you had asked is, how do the two organizations benefit from one another? I mean, IFC, being a private sector client, understands how do I manage my clients. So they really drove this notion of, we need a CRM and we need a client relationship management system that dovetails into our calendar and our email and some of these kinds of things. So they started the pilot, and then we were able to pull it into the bank. And bank business is now able to look at that client relationship management and say, gosh, I could use that to manage my relationships with, you know, my donors, my relationships with my ministers in different countries. So, you know, another interesting piece where end users benefited. And then the final piece we did was a really big RFP to go out to all the mobile carriers and say, listen, I don't want mobile contracts that are individual in 186 countries and then one for HQ, and where we pay, you know, a ton of money on roaming. We need a flat rate, and we need to give everybody the phone that we understand. So we rebid it. We've given everybody iPhones and Androids that we know, and now we've got, you know, mobile apps for approvals and those kinds of things that the end users said to us, this would make our lives really easy. You know, if I didn't have to carry my laptop because I had to make some approval in SAP, my life would be a lot easier. So those kinds of things, I think, have really made a difference too.
Some executives, anyway, as they approach the cloud, an area of caution is security. And again, given the distribution of your employees around the world, the extent to which many of them travel, how do you think about security? And especially as you understandably move more to the cloud, how do you think about the security stance that you're managing?
So it's interesting because we spend a lot of time on the security piece. As an international organization, we exist by charter, right? And people join us and they join the organization. So governments, we're actually in kind of a quasi-governmental organization. We are not regulated by any law, right? So the other thing that we needed to make sure is that by moving our information to the cloud, we weren't in any way violating our privileges and immunities that had been granted to us by any of our member states. So right now, a member state could not say to the bank, We'd like to sue you when you have to give us all of your data. It's protected by our privileges and immunity. So that was an added piece that was really important to us. So from a cloud perspective, we did two things. We started work with legal firms to say, gosh, we know we have to get over security issues. We know we need to get over our privileges and immunities. What might contracts look like if this is where we really want to push? And where could you as our outside counsel advise us that you would actually be comfortable letting us do something like moving that to the cloud? So we spent about 9 months with White & Case, and they really came back and said, here are some templates, here are some things for you to look at. And then what we did was created a risk framework. And we said, okay, inside that risk framework, we know what our information classifications are. And we also know if there were a breach, what would be the severity? What would it mean to us from either a financial perspective, from a reputational risk perspective, all those kinds of different things. We created a heat map. And then we created, through our own accountabilities and decision-making framework, a process by which the business owners would make the decision to move their data to the cloud. And so in the case of email, you know, the president of the World Bank Group said, I'm willing to take this risk because it's substantially better for the organization from a cost perspective, from a technology perspective, and where we're going to be able to take that with Microsoft. And I think finally from a security perspective, we have a great security team. And we have been building our own security team since about 2007 when we had our first breach. They do a terrific job. But we cannot keep all of our information safe. When you have 186 country offices and you have servers in every country offices and you have, you know, open USB ports and people who can, you know, stick in drives and, you know, I mean, we find these things all the time and, you know, when we're looking at our perimeter and what's going on in our country offices. And I think we finally came to the conclusion that from a security perspective, we might actually be safer in a Microsoft cloud than trying to protect our own fully distributed email system. You know, I think that was even a revelation for my security teams. Mm-hmm. Because I know that my CISO, when I first said we need to move to the cloud, oh, I gave him gray hair. But now he actually comes into my office and says things like, you know, I've been thinking about X, Y, and Z, and we can move this to the cloud. And, you know, we've gotten to a point where, so now that we've moved a piece of it to the cloud, we're actually in the process of bucketing all of our different platforms and applications to say, okay, all of this stuff could go to the cloud based on our risk frame now, and how do we get it there? Then there's some intermediate piece that says this might be a little too hard, but if we, you know, redesigned the application, we looked at the business process, we changed a few things, 2 or 3 years, we could get this into the cloud, and maybe there's this piece over here that never leaves, or maybe it doesn't leave for 5 years until we actually see, you know, the evolution of where the cloud goes and how, you know, certain platforms actually can create us, you know, platforms as a service. Mm-hmm. And my CISO is running that exercise for me. So we've come a long way.
That's great. That's really great. I also wanted to cover the fact, Stephanie, that you are a board-level CIO, that you are a part of the advisory board of Box.org, which is an organization that helps nonprofits be more productive and collaborative, a topic we've already talked about in your current day job and things you think about normally. You're also in the bank's Fund Staff Federal Credit Union. You're a member of the board of that. I wanted to just sort of understand the genesis of your board work, how these opportunities came to you, why you accepted them, and what you've gained out of being a part of a board and advising other parts of different organizations.
So Box.org is a really interesting story. And again, if you go back to when we took over this organization, what did we look like? So again, we were a Lotus Note shop. Everything was centralized in one of our big hubs, but mainly in HQ. So if you were a task team leader or an investment officer and you were going to a really difficult country with really bad connectivity, it was far easier for you to take confidential information, any information, and forward it to your Gmail account, put it in your Dropbox account. And because of the nature of our organization and because we always knew, and you know, this dates back to, you know, when the organization started, we knew we had people traveling all over the world. And so in some ways, our policies around, you know, what do you do with data and how do you use your, you know, your phone or your laptop has been to blur the corporate and the private. And I'm not sure we'll ever be able to change that because it's deeply ingrained in the culture. So we needed to find a solution for people to be able to do that exercise. So file, sync, and share safely and securely in a way that we felt really comfortable. So my infrastructure team came and said, we've got a great idea. Okay, well, what's your idea? Well, we're going to build My Briefcase, and we're going to put it in the DMZ, and we're going to put it in SharePoint, and people will stop using, you know, Dropbox, they'll stop using Google Mail. I sort of scratched my head a little bit. I have a few trusted advisors, one of whom is Steve Sinofsky. And I said, what do you think about this? And he said, Stephanie, you can't outrun technology. You cannot outrun what these guys are going to do. And every time that Dropbox adds a new feature, these guys are going to be coming back to you saying, why can't we do X, Y, and Z? And it won't work. So, go back to the drawing board. So we went back to the drawing board. And Karen Appleton, who's one of the senior VPs at Box, happened to come to visit me just about this same time and said, I work for this company called Box, and we really want to build our relationship with nonprofits. So here's what we do. Here's how we work. Would you guys be willing to partner with us? And I said, yeah, I think this is something we'd really like to do. And again, this is just when we were beginning to tiptoe into the cloud and how do we get comfortable with our data. And we had our Whiten case study. We knew what we needed from a security perspective, and Box really offered all of that to us. And so we partner very closely with Box. We have 28,000 users of Box. We have, terabytes of storage, and it grows. I mean, it grows by the week. And we are now at a place where we can say, we're going to block access to Gmail and access to Dropbox, and we're going to start pulling back people's ability to put our data where you don't know where it is. And through that experience, my whole team worked very closely with Box. And then they created Box.org to say, okay, how do we take this experience and other experiences they had with other organizations and really grow it and make it more valuable? And so I agreed to sit on the board. And we meet, well, we at least get together once a quarter, but we meet informally. And in my view, the value is, well, there's two values. One, how do we let Box know what it is we need? Because some of our needs are slightly different. And they might even be different than the corporate sector. But if you're thinking about, nonprofits and what nonprofits are doing, are the Box developers and do they have on their development plan things that are really going to help us, like our ability to keep our own keys? Some of those things like that, right? Where are they on your development curve? And who's pushing you to say, if you really want to grow this business, this is what you need? In exchange for that, and I think which is the other really big benefit, is that we have a couple of other kind of Silicon Valley companies who have been extremely helpful to what we're trying to do. So Palo Alto is a great example of a company where we started working with them when I was in IFC. Small little company just getting started. The value for money is fantastic. And the more time that we spend in the Valley, the more we find smaller companies who have really interesting solutions to problems that we have and are more than willing to work with us in ways that I think are unique and different from some of the big vendors. So that's why I think the Box.org thing is important. The Board Credit Union I've been on for, 10 years now. And that I consider that more kind of corporate duty, civic duty. But I enjoy it. And what's really interesting about it is that security and technology have become so much more important. And I'm the only board member who has any technology experience. So before you came today, actually, I was with the CISO from the credit union and the CEO with my CISO talking about some issues we have on some servers and how might we be thinking about creating heat maps and understanding where you have deferred maintenance and how you're thinking about that and how are you educating the board about that. So it's helpful to them too, I think.
That's great. And do you, especially on outside boards, do you find that you're gaining insights from others who have similarities to your role and responsibilities, but enough differences that you're kind of drawing inferences from them and translating back into this environment things that they've done? Does it lead to kind of inspiration as to new things you might be doing?
Not yet, but I think one of the areas, and this is something we haven't done yet, but we've been talking about doing, I think we need a private sector advisory board, and I haven't figured out how quite to construct that, but I think we can learn more from private sector companies. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we have done, which is really valuable, is we have created a network of all of the CIOs that work in all the international financial institutions, and we've begun to work much more closely with the UN. And so again, we can leverage one another, and we have in many ways very similar problems. We're in Liberia, and we're running off of VSAT, and guess what? We've lost connectivity. What do we do? And how do we solve that problem? And interestingly, could we solve it together? And solve it together in a way that might save all of our organizations more money. I also personally feel that we haven't leveraged the private sector enough as an organization, given the mission that we have. And my experience is very lately with companies like Box is that when you say, listen, our job is to alleviate poverty. What we really want to do is create shared prosperity in the world. People are up for that in helping us in ways that they wouldn't necessarily do with a corporate client. So how do we actually kind of capture and harness that and push it into a very bureaucratic contracts and kind of RFP, where everything has to be bid out and everything has to follow certain rules is difficult, but I think we can do it. And I think as we do it from a technology perspective, the other benefit it has is we can pull those technology companies into our operations. So, you know, the Microsofts of the world, Facebook Zero is a great example, right? What they want to do in giving, you know, free access to the internet in really poor countries is an interesting idea. And, you know, we have lots and lots of people who spend time with ministers and companies helping them try to figure that out. So being able to pair those kinds of people together is going to make a difference.
I wanted to, we've talked about a variety of interesting trends, whether it's cloud computing, collaborative technology, various things that have come up through the course of the conversation. Are there other things on your radar as you think about IT trends that are particularly exciting to you, to the bank that you're contemplating as you look a year, two, three out in the future?
Yeah, so it's data. It's all about data. And the reason why I say that is everything that the organization knows about development. And we're the only organization in the world that knows about development from the time that we were founded and, you know, to today, all over the world. And how do you take that information, some of it's structured, some of it's unstructured, mash it together with data sets that other people are creating, so mobile operators, you know, governments, countries, when they're working on, you know, poverty indicators, all mash it together and say, gosh, these are the five things we can learn from, you know, hydro projects we've done everywhere in the world, and we should do this differently. And we sit on a lot of that data. So we've got a lot of work to do in terms of cleaning it up and making sure it's consistent. And I don't think our situation is different from many other organizations. But and kind of within a silo, the data is fairly well captured and fairly well understood. But across silos, it's not quite so good. So we have created a data council. And the data council is chaired by the chief economist and by the MD COO. And my team sort of run it. And in essence, what we're really trying to do, we're really trying to tackle two fronts. So what's the internal data? How do we get control of our internal data so that you go all the way from the president's development site, which is, you know, his 12 goals, and how are we measuring those and how are we collecting that data, all the way down to that task team leader, and that there's consistency and that there's no manual intervention, you know, there's a golden source, all that kind of stuff. And then how do you marry that with data that's coming in from the outside? So we spend a lot of time with countries helping them gather data. They gather citizen data, they gather poverty data, they do, you know, household index surveys. We do them differently everywhere in the world, and everybody defines things differently. So there's a really big push, I think, from operational side to say, okay, how can we help kind of clean that up? So we're putting both of those together and creating kind of our own way to use that data. And I think it's going to be really exciting. When I very first met the president, he said, what do you really want to do? And I said, well, someday I'm going to take you to our salt mines because we're in Iron Mountain, and I want you to see the 14 football fields of project information that we have sitting there. If you could digitize that, you could change the world. And one of our MDs I was talking to about this, and he said, you know, it's really interesting. When I was writing my PhD, I wanted to find a way to prove that when they dammed the Suez Canal, that it actually changed the course of history for Egypt. And, you know, 1960s to today. And what did it mean from an economic perspective and from a political perspective? And how did it change the country? And he said, so I could anecdotally find things because the bank financed that project. He said, anecdotally, I could find that stuff through newspaper articles, through libraries, but I couldn't get at the core source of who actually did the project and what were they thinking about at the time. So under Bob Zolick, you know, we really started this access to information and opening up. So now scholars can come to us, and they can, the libraries and archives are actually in my purview as well. So they can come and they can order files and they can sit and peruse and actually use that, you know, to think differently about how do we do development. It's still very expensive for somebody in a developing country, you know, to fly here to get that kind of access. So we could figure out how to digitize that stuff and make it available to people to be able, you know, again, take the data sets, mash them up, and say, we could do this project differently. Mm. That's really cool.
That makes a lot of sense. Well, Stephanie von Friedeberger, thank you so much for joining us on the Forum on World Class IT, sharing your perspectives, your plans, so many of the things that have made you a successful executive. It's really been a great conversation.
Well, Peter, it's been really wonderful. Thank you for having me.
You You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call MetaStrategies Forum on World-Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World-Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the forum on World-Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to MetaStrategies' five principles of world-class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.